It'll be like biblical times. Everyone's living till they're like 900 years old.
Yeah, like Methuselah. Well, yeah.
And the only alternative we had before was to become a vampire.
So this just brought a whole bunch of doors just opened up.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. So the Twilight, you know, series is, you know, obsolete now.
Howdy. Welcome or welcome back to the Idea to Impact podcast. Today, we are continuing our discussion with Lance Anderson from Dickinson Wright in Austin, Texas. We continue our discussions about Lance's background and just exactly what's happening with the cannabis industry. Let's get started.
I have somebody I know. I don't want to call him a friend because he's not. I just happen to know him. He lives in Colorado. He grows his number of plants that, you know, and I know he personally uses it and he's very open about it, but he also like tips his contractors in pot, you know, so he doesn't use cash. He just uses it as kind of this bartering system. He goes, hey, they got to get their weed somewhere. So I guess everybody in Colorado just smokes, but you know, he's using his six plants, the surplus from his six plants in all these various other ways. So I think you're right. It's going to be very interesting to see how this, takes off because it's so ingrained in so many people's lives in various ways, from medicinal to recreational use already, right? This isn't right. Like, oh, it's a new thing. Everybody's going to start to, there's, it's,
yeah. You have grandparents and family members that you talk to that are, you know, very anti-marijuana,
right?
Anti-drug, now consuming or somehow partaking. Not necessarily recreationally, but for medicinal purposes,
right.
The topical anti-inflammatory purposes. But and
the topical stuff works. I mean, that's such a thing. It works, mm-hmm. Right?
And we have an entire endocannabinoid system with receptors that react to this stuff. Mm-hmm. You know, I mean, it works. Apparently it's something that's, you know, we developed as a receptor system to accommodate these types of compounds. And there's real anti-inflammatory effects for sure.
Right,
it's fascinating, and I'm excited to see how the industry develops, and of course the innovation behind all this, getting back to kind of the IP stuff, is endless. You know, you can, this is a, you know, not like working on a cotton plant, which was always difficult. This is, you know, eminently workable. You can breed these things, you can, you know, genetically modify or edit, which we can talk about in a little bit. To me, it's just fascinating what potential lies for a plant with so many different cannabinoids or compounds that it might be able, you might be able to leverage.
And let's talk about the genetic thing a little bit, because I don't know anything about the regulatory aspects of this. I'm going to make an assumption that there are certain jurisdictions around the world that either don't like genetically modified plants, or they tax them, or they, for some reason, they just don't like them. And now you have this CRISPR technology, this gene editing. Talk a little bit, if you would, about the current state of genetically modified plants for human use, and then how does the gene editing technology change, modify, affect that?
So,
and talk to me like I'm a kindergartner, because I don't know anything about it.
You bet.
So, everything I know.
So if you go back to the 1990s, okay, when I mentioned this earlier, I mean, you essentially had a revolution in agriculture, the biotechnology revolution, and it was basically where they could insert a gene into a plant that would give certain traits to that plant. And you would see things such as insect resistance, disease resistant.
Do I get my seedless grapes and seedless watermelon because of this, or
is that potentially? Okay. You know, those actual products that are being sold are most likely, you know, through breeding or traditional breeding.
Gotcha. Okay.
But yeah. So what, you know, the products that came out in the market were primarily for commercial agriculture, herbicide resistance, insect resistance, and other drought tolerance or disease tolerant. Transgenics.
And am I taking like a frog DNA, or where am I getting this gene?
The insect resistance one was a toxin that was produced from a bacteria. So Bacillus thuringiensis.
Really? So yeah. This is why the anti-GMO folks are like, hey, they're putting toxic stuff into your, because sometimes they are putting toxins in, right? I mean, at least at a genetic level, right?
At a genetic level, and it causes the plant to produce this toxin. Now, it's not toxic to humans. That's sure. The other cool thing about it. It was very toxic to certain insect species, but not toxic to humans. And of course, not toxic to the ecosystem that plant existed in when you had beneficial insects flying around, as long as they didn't eat it. But you know, they called that BT, named after the bacterial strain. And the BT corn and cotton was a game changer. So when we would check crops back in the day, you would look for the Southwestern corn borer and the European corn borer, and we would see presence in the field and be like, oh crap, you know, call in the flyboys or pump it through the pivot sprinkler, you know, all these compounds. And they were back then, again, I'm surprised, you know, I'm standing here with you today. I mean, we were flying on, you know, heavy pyrethroids, which are generally safe and metabolized by the body, but we were also flying on or pumping organophosphates, this compound called Lorsban, which is no longer labeled for use. That's toxic. That sits in your fat reserve.
That third eye is starting to come right about here.
Yeah.
I see.
Yeah,
it is. It's coming out.
Exactly.
Growing
yeah.
it.
Yeah. No telling, but it's, you know, this is hot stuff. And so to me, to have transgenics come in and provide an alternative and keep us from spraying all those types of chemicals on, I was thrilled. And then you start hearing about Monsanto coming out with the Terminator gene. I don't know if you recall this. So basically, and it's difficult from a patenting standpoint. If I have a patented plant and you buy it from me, can you go replant that seed that you harvest off that plant? Seems like you could.
Yeah. You
know, because it's your plant.
I'm buying the fruits of what I bought. It's a fruit of what I.
Right. And so there's this whole body of case law about, it's called patent exhaustion. If I sell you my patented invention, okay, I have a phone, I'm going to sell it to you.
Yeah.
You have it. It's yours. You can do whatever you want with it. I can't come back and sue you because I have a patent on some part of that phone.
Gotcha.
And so that exhaustion theory was tested at the Supreme Court based on replicable technology. Mm-hmm. And so Monsanto, of course, won.
Right.
But before that, their solution, besides taking it to court and going and suing, you know, the small farmer, was to develop a gene they called the Terminator gene, which would render the progeny of that protected variety sterile so that the next year the seed wouldn't grow. Pretty darn brilliant.
It is. Is this why there is a big push for heirloom seeds now? That because a lot of the plants don't produce seeds that you can then use to grow again?
Kind of the hybrid. Well, you know, hybrid seeds are, you know, kind of follow that same path because they'll all basically differentiate after that. And so you'll lose that hybrid uniformity. But there's, you know, hybrid technology was kind of your classic way of protecting your innovative, you know, cultivars, is, you know, not strains. In fact, the weed business calls it strains. We shouldn't call it that. They're cultivars. You know, strains are for bacteria, but I digress.
I thought you originally said the cult of ours.
Cult of ours. No, cultivar.
Our cult.
It basically is the same.
Okay. So that's really fascinating. So intellectual property and legal protection actually puts forth this standard now in the way plants are grown and not regrown, I guess. Right. That's pretty fascinating. How one area can affect this other area and become a normal part of our lives. Yeah.
And if you throw in even another concept, there's a international treaty that allows for plant breeders' rights in the member nations, the US and most developed nations. That allows for protection of the variety that you develop, but it gives exceptions. One is a research exemption. So you can take my protected variety and go make more varieties. Okay. The other exemption is the farmer's exemption or brown bagging. So you can harvest my protected variety and replant it for yourself as long as you don't go sell it to someone else.
Gotcha.
You're seeing a balance with some of that, that body of law.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
Patenting is a little more rigid And so they were Monsanto's, and I shouldn't pick on Monsanto. It's pretty much all the ag bio companies were trying to use utility patent filings.
All three of them?
Yep.
Exactly. Go ahead, sorry.
So it's pretty interesting. So that was in the 90s, right? Now,
okay, gotcha.
Monsanto came out with the Terminator gene. That Terminator gene resulted in a huge PR fiasco. And that's really where people were like, wait a minute, you know, we're playing with Mother Nature here. The Frankenfoods conversations come out. So the GMOs have got a bad rap, okay? And then you're seeing the result even to this day in the form of non-GMO on the labeling or organic, right? And frankly, we have a lot of that in our home here. So there's kind of a PR element to this and a consumer element to this, in addition to the regulatory. So every country has its own regime for genetically modified organisms. A lot of that standard is based on the fact you're inserting foreign DNA into that plant.
Gotcha.
Now, here we are today. We've got another revolution at our doorstep. It is kind of this second wave of biotechnology advancement, and it will be on the shoulders of this CRISPR platform or variations thereof. And what that is a protein introduced that is capable of cleaving a genetic sequence at a desired location and altering the genetic material that way. It's like not
a snippet and then just like film, like the old movies. I used to film editing type of thing.
Cut and paste.
Okay.
Yeah. I mean, it's literally an editing. It's clean. It doesn't require using bacteria vectors to get it in the cell. It's pretty slick stuff.
You're not using like toxins.
It's
supposed to be cleaner, safer.
And so that editing capability, now there's still the ability, in my opinion, to get what you could consider foreign DNA sequences in there. Okay. But for the most part, it's manipulating what's already in the cell.
Gotcha.
And so you're knocking out a lot of genes or a lot of functional aspects of the genetic makeup. And that could affect the biosynthetic pathways. So you can make things different colors. I'm thinking from the standpoint of plants, okay?
Right, of course.
You can make food products different colors. You can take out the gene that gives susceptibility to disease, and you can just knock these things out or manipulate them to give the desired effect. And guess what? It's not GMO.
Right.
That's what we're starting to see. And that's what's impressive about this new opportunity is that we can come up with altered plant cultivars, okay, or plant traits that are very, very helpful to society, to feeding the world's hunger problem, to, you know, resisting disease. And I mean, we can solve all these problems. It won't be given that stigma of being GMO. Right.
It's kind of like the clean energy of food, right? Like, hey, we get this nice, clean, cleaned up thing, it produces more, or it doesn't have all of the mutations or something like that. And it's not toxic, right? There's no pollutant of analog to it.
Yeah.
Right? Okay.
Right. And yet, if you stop and think about that, you're like, wait a minute, if I alter a gene in a plant and it becomes something that goes and makes progeny out in the world, you're going to cross-pollinate and have those same traits passed down?
Mm-hmm.
So I'm not sure it does solve everything, but it's certainly another run or another bite at the apple, no pun intended, trying to get these advances through in a manner that's not deemed negative by the public.
So, are they going to have to kind of rethink like what the term like GMO means, because to me it's always fascinating all of the politics that go behind some of these terms, what does organic mean, and like what is, you know, range free or cage free eggs, like what are all these things mean? Some of them mean absolutely nothing, like they're not regulated at all. And like, is kind of the similar thing happening with THC and hemp and all of that?
It is an interesting concept, and you're seeing it play out as a function of, okay, you've got public perception,
mm-hmm.
and a lot of regulatory frameworks are being across the world, not just the US, are put together to kind of ensure labeling requirements are there, et cetera. All right. And then jump right over to, you know, and that's FDA, right, in the US. Well, that's also FDA from the standpoint of, you know, beneficial effects or, you know, claims of, you know, any efficacy. And so it's got to be tested and regulated by the FDA. And right now the FDA for cannabis, for example, to jump back into that, the FDA is saying you can't say it's a food supplement, nor can you say it's, you know, has any efficacy. It's not a medicine, nor is it a food supplement. And you're like, well, what the heck did we say? We're able to kind of help navigate the risk profile of labeling, but this applies just as much in the GMO context as well. You've got to go through your regulatory process to sell, to import and sell for consumption these food products.
Yeah. Okay. You know, speaking of labeling and kind of like, it'll be kind of interesting to see, like, you know, because Europe does this a lot with like wine, you know, and countries do it. They have things that you can put on the label, and in order to put like DOC, you have to, your vineyard has to follow these kind of qualifications. So I'm always interested, you know, if it becomes, you know, approved at the federal level, what kind of labeling we're going to start seeing of the different, you said not strains, but different varieties of marijuana. And, you know, in order to have this label, your grower must use this, or, you know, must do that. That'll be interesting.
It will be. And look, it could get worse. You know, there was a concern for a while that if the FDA descheduled this, that they would then take domain over the administration of it. And therefore everything would have to be FDA approved.
Right.
And that would basically screw everything up. Right.
Yep.
And so that still may happen. I mean, just because it's made legal, if they put a regulatory framework over it that says you've got to have this be an FDA approved product, like a, you know, like a drug.
That takes years.
Oh, you're in pharma now. You're at a pharma.
You're business. In pharma. You yeah. are. And so there was a fear that if it went that course, you would have kind of a chilling effect. And honestly, if you make it too fragmented at the state level, you could have a chilling effect just the same, albeit in different ways at a much larger scale.
Yeah.
In the last, you know, half hour or so that we have here, I'd like to try to segue into what you're seeing coming out of university research and how that's, you know, it would be great if we could segue it into our previous discussion. So if you're seeing stuff that's
all
coming
out
of
various pot.
Cultivars, I'm going to remember cultivars now. You know, what are we seeing? First of all, I'm just interested. Are university researchers working on things that are either directly or indirectly related to the cannabis industry? Are you seeing that?
A little bit. I think you're seeing definitely hemp research or hemp or capabilities applicable to the legal hemp industry. And again, that's the same plant. It just happens to be a cultivar that has less than 0.3% dry weight THC.
Gotcha.
So you're already seeing a lot of that happen. Some of it's from the breeding standpoint. Others, it's interesting, like secondary markets of this plant, not just consumption of its extracts, but maybe textiles, biofuels, other applications of a very versatile plant with very high biomass on a relative scale. In fact, one of the highest, you know, biomass plants out there.
Is it really? So I could make biodiesel out of it or something like that if I had to, or something?
I mean, biofuels, rope, clothes, you name it. Additives, industrial chemicals. I mean, there's all sorts of cool stuff we can do with this plant. And I think you're seeing universities really be at the forefront of some of those opportunities. Honestly, they were already doing some of this.
Yeah.
So specialized materials, industrial materials, and things like that. You're seeing, you know, quite a few institutions focus on that.
Yeah, they're limited to the legal elements because of federal grants and federal funding. So I'm assuming the federal grants they're not going to fund illegal stuff, right?
Or not yet. Now there's one University of Mississippi that is kind of the one federal federally funded laboratory for cannabis research.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. So it's been there for a while. So what I think they're doing is beginning to break that up as well and expand that to other institutions.
And so you mentioned other types of protection, like trademarks and like brands. That's a whole big area too. I mean, we talked yesterday about some of the like celebrities who have their names attached to trademarks or brands, and just the money that's coming from that too.
Absolutely. And I guess you're referring to the cannabis business, right? Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's, you know, there are lots. We've heard about Willie Nelson getting into the process or into the market, the Marley family. You've got Snoop Dogg, you've got Wiz Khalifa, all with branded products in different regulated markets. That's absolutely something. And we work on that on a daily basis. And actually, when you're going into work in a state, I can't be a big brand and just go decide to go set up in Michigan or Nevada.
Right.
I've got to work with locally approved licensed operations in each one of those. Well, that's not good because I've got my proprietary stuff. Okay. I also have my brand that I'm trying to get into their hands, but I don't trust them to manage the brand the way I manage it. So now I've got to have these huge contracts that tell them what they can do with the brand, how they can sell it, what they can sell, how good it has to be. I got to be able to test it, make sure the quality is there to establish goodwill. Oh, and then I'm going to give them some recipes, which are trade secrets. Okay. Mm-hmm. So now you've gone from trademarks and branding to now trade secrets. And maybe I have some proprietary strains that I use in connection with those products. So now I got to get that to them. Now you paid a lawyer $50,000 and you've got a 60-page agreement, and people wonder why this industry is so complex.
Mm-hmm. Right.
I love working in this space, but I will tell you the transactions I've worked on in the last 2 years in the cannabis industry rival or exceed the complexity of pharmaceutical transactions that I work on to this day. It's amazing. So
if I'm in like a college of ag, I'm wanting to do research that could be commercial, that's commercializable, okay, and is protectable. It sounds like I can work on plant varieties and things like that, but I could also work on like a special type of hoe or a special type of auger or something that's related to the industry that isn't necessarily directly, isn't the plant itself, right? And are you seeing any of that at universities?
But yeah, I mean, we've talked about in the cannabis industry, the same thing applies in things like the dairy industry. That I got to witness firsthand, where they come in based on some change in the laws in California, they move into Texas and New Mexico. You can make a lot of money with the picks and shovels approach. Okay, so that would be also referred to as ancillary markets. And the ancillaries are very, very good areas to play in, where you're able to design and develop technologies and just think from a plant trait development, processing, enhancements in processing.
Right.
In disease or moisture or fertility detection. And there's a lot of great technology coming out right now, including out of Israel, on advances in kind of diagnostics for plants, where you're able to use imaging technology, spectral imaging, to see what's going on. And it can tell you everything from, you know, pest infestation to fertility to and lack thereof, all the way to moisture content. And so these are companies that, and in fact, I've seen them go through some of the angel investing networks, and even in Austin, all dealing with kind of plant developments that have nothing to do with the plant itself. It's around the plant, right, and making the whole experience either more efficient, more profitable, or faster or denser, et cetera.
Because we talked about this small, you know, the small grower, the small guy, and how they might be being pushed out. But the whole idea, at least from the layman's perspective, is that, you know, if I can get ahead of this wave 10 years from now, I'm going to be in clover. Now, that's becoming difficult when you're dealing with the plant itself. But that, I would assume that the opportunity is still there for you know, cannabis itself, but without having to deal with the plant, right? And I'm still dealing with all these other aspects of researching how to grow things well, how to, you know, we talked about editing, but the picks and shovel, is that right? Picks and shovel?
Correct.
I would assume that there are a lot of folks that are working on that. We have what are called the Leech Teaching Gardens. Leech is the benefactor's name, but we have the teaching gardens here at Texas A&M. So there is a whole group of folks that are really interested in how do we grow things better, even if it's for small sustainable farms or small sustainable areas. And so I would imagine that there are commercializable opportunities even in that space, right?
Absolutely. And you have a lot of innovation going into that. And yeah, it may spin out of the cannabis world, but you have a lot of innovation in just, you know, fruit, nut culture, you know, right. Greenhouse technologies, things that affect our food supply, whether it keeps it fresh, whether it analyzes ripening processes. I mean, things that if you think about the supply chain, there's a lot you can do to innovate in that space. And that is being innovated in that space. And there's a ton of money in that. If you strike the right vein of opportunity there, the scale is just immense. And so that picks and shovels approach is alive and well, and you're seeing it all the time. Oh, and then let's throw on top of that software and technology development and the advent of machine learning and AI and how those things can even increase further the ability to diagnose, detect, grade, give, you know, attributions of certain qualities from one product to the next.
Sure, sure. Inventory control of large farms or things like that. Sure.
Yeah. And then keep going. Look, we can talk about advances in, okay, you've heard about the microbiome of the body. Okay.
Yes.
We've got a lot of microorganisms that we coexist with and actually rely on. The claim applies to plants. And so there's this whole next level of study and advance, honestly, on nutrient uptake and, you know, via manipulation of the microbiome that plant enjoys, a lot of that within the root systems and the soils that they exist in.
That's really interesting. Because I know the gut biome and the microbiomes and all those organisms like that live in our stomachs. That's one thing, Jack, that Andy and I always get, you know, talking about when we're in the office together, because there have been so many companies in the last couple of years that have been created and started that are offering services to help people understand their own gut biome and not just understand what's there, but okay, now how do I manipulate it to make it better? Or if it's unhealthy and I've got bacteria in there that's not good, how do I, now the company is saying, okay, well, now we have these supplements we can sell you, you know, to make it better. And it's just, it's really neat to see, you know, things that, you know, 20, 30 years ago, you could only do in a doctor's office, or now they just ship you a kit and you send them a sample and then you get results, you know, and like for a fraction of the cost.
Right. I would assume that there are a lot of opportunities at universities to do cross-disciplinary ventures, especially in areas that need customer education, for example, right? Where you're, the gut biome, what's that, right? And so there are, I mean, it's a whole college that's dedicated to education. We have a whole school that's dedicated to business, including marketing. We have, you know, we have a whole college of agriculture, and we have a pharmacy school and things like that. There are a lot of areas where if researchers came together for the commercial activity, for the commercial entity, talk about a biome, we kind of have this ecosystem already built in here to universities like Texas A&M. You know, and I'm just looking at Texas A&M, Lance. You see a lot of different universities. What are the few things that you're seeing in successful commercialization operations at universities?
I really like to see kind of these interdisciplinary skill sets. And you mentioned the pharmacy school. To me, that is one that can bring together all sorts of things and deliver it. Okay. We could be talking about anything. And it can come from, you know, all ends of the campus, but that pharmacy school is a core kind of functional element to advancing that to be applied to humans or to be absorbed or ingested by humans. So it's schools like that I really get excited about. You know, at a general level, health sciences, great, but you know, you start to see the combination of computing power with any of this, right? So the microbiome is a great example. If you had, you know, certain microbiology capabilities off in the biology college or unit, you know, they would love to take advantage of some of the computing power. And I'm sure they do through some of the core facilities at A&M, just like that exist at other institutions where they have supercomputing, you know, power, but give them, you know, access to reams of data that didn't exist or they didn't have access to before. Mm-hmm. Continuing that is critical. And I think the interdisciplinary, as far as if I'm, you know, putting my wish list or my hat on to say, right, I'm running this university, you know, it would really be, and honestly, we as a law firm are doing this. We're saying, hey, corporate attorney, you need to talk to this intellectual property attorney, because what that intellectual property attorney is dealing with is something you'll be able to help with as far as fundraising and things like that. And that cross-selling mm-hmm. is synergistic.
Yeah,
and that would apply just as much in a university setting. You know, you both know it does.
Right?
Can you get everyone to sit in a room and kind of have that collaborative expansion? It's a challenge, and it's often fraught with, you know, difficulty or bureaucracy, et cetera. But you know, you got to just get out of the way sometimes and let these brilliant minds go to work. And so I'm a big fan of cross-selling, cross-disciplinary activities, and again, get it in the hands of the consumer or the patient or the human,
right,
however you want to term it. Mm-hmm. What schools do that, right? Material sciences, pharmaceutical mm-hmm. sciences, things like that to me are kind of nice low hanging fruit, no pun intended again, to leveraging that stuff.
Mm-hmm.
We see that, you know, a lot of the efforts that Beth does as the educational concierge is trying to change culture, because you talked a lot about you know, bureaucracy and things like that. Even if the bureaucracy is leveled, until the culture of the university becomes one where that interdisciplinary work is somewhat normal, you know, where it people will think of it on their own, or it's encouraged somehow. And we're trying to do that at Texas A&M, but I do think there's a lot of work to be done on that culture. And you know, Beth, you know more about this than I do. Mm-hmm. But I've also seen other universities where that culture exists. It may have changed from 10 years ago, and now they're at the heyday of understanding the benefits of working together on these types of things. But I think we're still working on that at Texas A&M. And it takes resources, because if we're going to commit to changing the culture, we can't just say, well, great, let's change the culture, right? We've got to have some type of investment from the administration too.
It takes a lot of work, and I think like there's things being done here in pockets and like bubbles, and if we could just, like Lance said, get, you know, like the corporate attorney to talk to the IP attorney, if you could just get the schools talking, you know, to each other. And then I think, you know, one thing I've noticed is just, I think we kind of mentioned or brought it up earlier, it's that not everyone knows about commercialization. You know, right. I went through A&M, I have 2 degrees from A&M, and I had not heard about commercialization until my postdoc, you know? Mm-hmm. And so Lance, for our listeners, maybe who don't know a lot about commercialization, maybe didn't even know that IP attorneys were a thing, can you kind of tell us in your kindergarten language, what is it that you do, and how can an IP attorney help a university faculty member?
Thanks, Beth. And you're right. It's and every institution has a different set of issues, right? Some are just so big that it's hard to kind of turn that ship. These take time, right? And it all requires champions at the administrative level. And so if you've got one school not that should talk to the other school, or where do those schools connect in the hierarchy, and getting that to all happen, right?
Yeah.
But harnessing innovation is, you know, it should be considered a benefit to society just as much as disseminating knowledge via an article, if not more. You're reaching the marketplace. In order to reach the marketplace, you've got to have competitive differentiation. You've got to have consumers wanting to buy your product. Okay. Now, Texas A&M, or any institution for that matter, isn't in the business of selling products or goods or services to, right, to consumers, right? So how do they do it? And therein lies the challenge. You've got this kind of second function that we all should be, you know, serving, that work within universities and institutions, but it's very difficult because they're not built for that. And right, so you've got to get it in the hands of someone that is built for that. And it could be a supply chain issue, a logistics issue, a distribution issue. It could be a regulatory issue. And sometimes this costs money. Well, how do you get money to, you know, to make this happen? You've got to have someone that invests or considers this worth the risk of that money to go make a bunch of money. Okay. So if it's a drug, you've got a regulatory process you got to go through. Who's going to pay for that?
Right.
Is the university going to cut a check? Or say you've got a health sciences center that develops a cool new patient software. You're going to cut a check? Some institutions do. There's a hospital right, system in the Northeast that just stroked a check for a software company that was developed in the walls, and they had a huge patient population. They deployed it to the patient. That company went public and the university made hundreds of millions of dollars. And they're saying, this is easy. It's a challenge. And right, we all know that this has been going for 30 years since Bayh-Dole came out, 40 years, I think, in 1980.
81, right?
Yeah. So, you know, we're still trying to get it right. It's an inexact science. And so what, okay, so now move on to intellectual property rights. What you do to develop value is somehow secure that intellectual property position to harness that innovation to then get it to that next set of hands that's going to take it to market.
Out of the business, the patent just becomes something on the shelf, right? Mm-hmm. So you do need both, I'm assuming, right?
Bingo.
Yeah.
You hit it on the head. You got to have both.
Yeah. What is the ROI for universities? Because from what we've seen, unless you get a lightning strike like a Gatorade or a Google or this hospital, you know, that made the investment and it ended up, you know, most universities don't have home run after home run after home run. What is the return on investment, or what's the incentive for universities to make those types of investments, not just in the individual technologies themselves, but in the program, like the tech transfer office and turning of the culture and trying to get interdisciplinary work done? Why should a university care about that, in your opinion? And I know you've seen a lot of them.
Yeah, and I'm maybe a little jaded. I think the ROI needs to back off on the R,
yeah, and right,
focus okay on the I. I think, you know, part of the issue is structuring these regimes to be to accommodate multiple things. One is strategic relationships where research funding comes in, where a technology commercialization officer is being graded on royalty and income, but yeah, I could have brought in, you know, $500,000 in industry funding, and I don't get credit for that. The research office gets credit for it.
Right. That's exactly how it works here, right? Yeah.
Yeah. But I mean, you know, it's not about making money. The minute you make it about making money, it's failed, right? Mm-hmm. It's more than that. And we've touched on a few of those issues. One would be, you know, we've got a societal duty, and it needs to be ingrained in our recruitment, our advancement, and our retention of innovative faculty, okay, mm-hmm, to encourage that. We need to have, you know, the ability to play the game the way like a private equity company would play it, where universities just get in with the founders as owners, okay, and not overlay this, you know, royalty bearing license structure that you can't go license without getting our approval and
right,
all the agreements that I used to, you know, champion around and say this is the way to do it, you know, may not always be the easiest path. And so being able to jump in and play the game the way any private equity or venture capital group plays the game, and except your contribution is the intellectual property asset.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. We do joint ventures all the time with private companies where one company's dropping in a bunch of patents, the other company's dropping in a bunch of money.
Mm.
One company's in charge of taking it to market, the other company just sits back and collects the check. Why can it not be that simple?
Yep.
Now, it costs a lot of money to set those up. There's a legal spin to it. There's risk from a security standpoint. But again, if you're going to maximize value, everyone needs to think in the context of How can we stay market? Okay. Meaning stay within what everyone knows and what everyone does.
Right.
You know, they used to say, if you want to get investment, you have to form a Delaware C corporation.
Right.
Right. And so everybody formed Delaware C corporations. That's again, taking it to the extreme, but there are kind of ways that it's done out there. And if universities can find ways, and I know there's examples, I think it was Arizona State really went hard to get like industry alumni to come back and kind of run, you know, just like run ventures the way they, you know, were taught to do so in the industry. There can be examples of that that we glean from with some universities, but there's not a magic bullet and everyone's different. Some are big, some are small, some are public, some are private. You've got sovereign immunity that comes into play. You've got, you know, enforcement. We've got California system right now is saying all of you companies in the lighting industry are infringing our filament LED patents. And so we're going to sue the hell out of you.
Really?
They are. They have sued a lot of companies. They said, we're tired of it. We're going to set an example for all universities. Okay, that's great. I was working at a small university and we got involved in one of those. And the scientist calls me and says, hey, you remember that we, you know, threw a fit about not getting a check when that case settled? And I was like, yeah. And they said, well, the company that had to pay us just told one of my former grad students that we will never, ever again hire a student out of that university.
Oh, man. Oh, I was thinking about sponsored research too, right? That's another issue, but employment of that and the bitter tastes left in the mouth from a lawsuit.
So you got to think about all of these things as a university, and they're all different. Some are big, some are small, some can command that kind of respect. Others are going to get beat up.
Yeah.
So the key is, you know, try to look the part, play the same role that everyone, you know, so that no one's looking at something that's new because no one wants to take a risk on that.
Right. Oh. That's really, really, really helpful. You know, we have a new president coming in. You know, Mike Young knew about commercialization from his experiences at Washington and Utah. And with Kathy Banks coming in June 1st as the new president of Texas A&M, being someone who for the last 10 years has been in the College of Engineering and knows the importance of commercialization, I think the future looks bright for Texas A&M in this commercialization space. So I'm very excited.
Congratulations in advance. I mean, you need that champion at that level. And so, absolutely. That's great to hear.
Mm-hmm. So Lance, what's next for you, either for you personally or for your practice? What are you seeing coming up and around the bend?
You're seeing a lot of innovations in business models. I think if you know, you can talk about the cannabis space, but in general, there's what are called SPACs, special purpose acquisition companies, and so we're starting to work with some of those. There's, you know, they're basically blank check companies. It's like forming a public private equity company, if that makes sense. And its job is to go buy other companies, combine them, make them much more valuable, and then sell them for a return for a public stock. And so they basically go public with some initial capital and raise a whole lot more capital. So we've got some of those that we're working on. They're really exciting.
Dickinson Wright is working on that as a firm, or your practice area? Or?
Our practice area, the cannabis group, Dickinson Wright's kind of finding itself involved in some of these.
Gotcha.
You know, and it's definitely a different animal, but it's a great vehicle, and it's kind of the buzzword in several industries, including real estate, high tech, cannabis, we mentioned. And so those are, that's pretty unique. And it also can really allow the sponsors that bring in that early risk capital to really leverage that. So instead of bringing $10 million and spending it on a company, you can go to one of these SPACs and go public and raise $120 million. Everybody's better off.
That sounds exciting, actually.
Yeah.
Those are
interesting models. And of course, we're all just watching. I mean, I'm excited about the CRISPR platform. I'm excited about the advance of the industry and plant technologies. I've been waiting around. We went through some of my background. It was almost like a happy accident. And so if there's an opportunity for me to add value to any client based on that weird upbringing, feels like, you know, that time's now. And so I've been enjoying kind of getting my feet wet on some of that. Really excited to see the CRISPR platform. That's probably the most exciting thing going on. When you start looking at the advance of CRISPR on one end, AI on the other end, and then like gene therapy or personalized therapies from the healthcare perspective, that's almost like a trinity of technology that's going to, you know, we'll end up curing cancer and all living to be way too old.
Yeah. Right. That's so 21st century.
Yeah.
Early 2000s. Yeah. That's all. And if anybody wants to contact you, either because of your special skill set or if they just want to explore what Dickinson and Wright can do, should they contact you directly?
Absolutely. Reach out anytime. Okay. My email's on the website. It's easy to find. If not, reach out to you guys. I hope you guys can pass it along for me.
But, absolutely. Yeah. We'll have it in the show notes and we'll have it in the description on the podcast and on the videos as well.
Yep. And we'll have to have you back, Lance, back when we're back to in-person office hours. Side note, Lance and his colleague, Stephen Mason, were the original two attorneys that came to our office hour program. So we've kept up with that. We've had virtual ones and, you know, we have a lot of attorneys now helping, but hopefully we can have you back. And I know you love coming to College Station, you know, being Texas Tech, so.
Yeah, you know, I've really expanded my horizons lately. And, you know, part of that I attribute to going to College Station. But, you know, I love it, especially when you go with someone like Stephen Mason, who, you know, lives and breathes, you know, Texas A&M. And we all share that entrepreneurial spirit. And it's just a matter of kind of tapping into it because it's there.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, this has been amazing. Yes. Lance, thank you for giving up 2 hours of time that you can't bill. You know, hopefully you won't send us a bill for your time.
I was say my payment was, you know, we'd resort to break out in song and Jack and I get our guitars out, but I guess we'll just have to wait until the next episode.
We're going to have to do a special episode on.
Yeah. We'll have to get Lance and Steven on at the same time. And then that'll be like an 8-hour podcast.
That's right. The living room jam coming to you live by Zoom. You know, we'll do a live stream. How about that?
Me and Mason will sing and then you guys can play the instruments.
There you go. There you go.
All right, well, join us next week. We will continue talking with inventors, IP attorneys. You're never going to know who you're going to see on here. So signing off, we'll see you next week.
Bye, everybody.
All right.